possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, the Prague Symphony Orchestra, and pianist Nava Perlman, and the Imani Winds visit Krannert Center in March. For more information about their performances, visit KrannertCenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Sangamon Auditorium, UIS Springfield, presenting The On Trio on Friday, March 4th at 8 p.m. The On Trio is a classical music ensemble composed of three sisters, a cellist, pianist, and violinist, all graduates of the Juilliard School of Music. Ticket information is available at 800-207-6960.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this second hour of the program, we'll be talking with novelist and journalist Donald Farr about his most recent novel, a book that came out last fall titled The Fearless Man. It's set in Vietnam. Our guest, the author, served in Vietnam. He's a decorated vet, received the Bronze Star and Purple Heart for his service in Vietnam. When he came back, he covered the anti-war movement for the Milwaukee Journal and later became the Journal's senior political reporter. He is a graduate of Harvard College and is the author of three previous novels, Cold River, Neverlight, which is also set in Vietnam, and Temple and Chipman, and now makes his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The book, The Fearless Man, is out now in bookstores. You certainly should be able to find it if you'd like to read it. Random House is the publisher, and our guest, Donald Farr, is talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask is people just try to be brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many callers. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Farr, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
I'm delighted to be your guest.
We certainly appreciate it. As I mentioned, you've written several novels here, and there's an earlier one that also was set in Vietnam, which is a little bit different, and we can talk a little bit about that book and about this one. And obviously, this is something that stuck with you. Had you been wanting to write more about Vietnam for some time?
I thought when I finished Neverlight, which was published in 82, and there was a paperback edition of that in 84, that I had written myself out on Vietnam. But I, as the years passed, I realized it was with me as vividly day by day as it had ever been. And I determined through a little bit of self-analysis or reflection that part of the reason for that was that as a naval gunfire officer in Vietnam, I was a Navy lieutenant serving with the Marines, providing naval gunfire support to Marines in combat. That is, I was with the Marines on the ground in the rice paddy, and I would get on the radio and call in naval gunfire, that I had undergone a kind of a split in my psyche. Your job, my duty over there, was to minimize Marine casualties by the use of heavy weapons. The United States does not send soldiers into combat naked. We cover them insofar as possible with artillery, naval gunfire, and air power. And so my motto over there was, let no Marine die through my neglect. If Marines were approaching a tree line and I was with them and a machine gun opened up on us, we all hit the deck, and it was my job, if it was appropriate, that is to say, if I had the right weapon to do the job, to silence that machine gun. So that job is to minimize Marine casualties. On the other hand, there's another part of your personality or your brain that recognizes what happens at the end of the trajectory of that 5-inch 54 naval rifle or the 105-millimeter howitzer. And it is not pretty. And it results in damage and death. So over the course of the years, I found that this gap in my personality, I don't mean to say that I was nuts, but I did feel that I wasn't fully integrated because I was both of these men. And I thought that if I wrote another novel about Vietnam and painted on a broader canvas this time, I could get deeper into my understanding of the damage that is inflicted on the psyche by combat and the means with which men who have done that integrate or reintegrate the psyche. In other words, how do you handle what you know you have done, even though you know you should have done it? That's the problem.
I was very struck by the epigraph that you chose for this book. It's from Melville,
right.
And it reads like this: "Happy are they and charmed in life who through long wars arrive unscarred at peace."
Right.
And I guess the thing I thought right off was, does anyone? Arrive unscarred?
I think the answer to that, the answer that I would give is no. However, there are people, combat veterans who have cauterized a certain segment of their nervous system so that, and I know some of these guys, so that it appears that they came through unscathed, or as Melville would say, unscarred. But I think that cauterization is itself a kind of scarring. I don't claim any moral superiority over those guys. All I say is that I wasn't able to do that. I think when you do that, you lose something in the process. And, of course, you know, there are psychopaths in the world. There are some psychopaths in the military, just as there are on police forces or in your own neighborhood. But if you take a normal man, and in Vietnam, the combatants were men, the women served nobly as nurses and as donut dollies and in the press, but not in combat units in that era. But if you take these men and you ask them how they feel about it 30 years hence, 40 years hence, I think one answer you would get that it would be awfully revealing, and you certainly would get this from me, is, I feel like it happened yesterday. And that, it seems to me, has got to say something about the process of absorbing the experience. I think it indicates you are still absorbing the experience, probably no matter how long you live.
That's really, I think it's really such a, this idea that as a nation, in a lot of ways, that we have tried to put this behind us and we have said, well, gee, that's a long time ago and we're done with that. But obviously, for people who fought there, it's not easy. It may be impossible to do that. And then, of course, you have to ask the larger question of whether actually as a nation, it's possible to do that or not.
Well, I think we found out in this last presidential campaign that it's not behind us. When I started The Fearless Man, it was several years before the presidential campaign. In fact, I think I started this book in January 98, because I just checked my first notebook a couple of days ago, because that question popped into my head. How long did I work on this book? And in 98, when I first started this book, I believe the nation regarded Vietnam as history. It seemed remote and in the past. Then in the campaign for president, John Kerry put the issue front and center. The issue had surfaced again in 2000 because Bill Clinton was a draft dodger. And it came up again in 2004 because Kerry emphasized his leadership capacity based partly on his Vietnam experience. No, I don't think this country has gotten over Vietnam, not only because we lost, but because, and this is a personal opinion, and many of your listeners will perhaps vehemently disagree, we betrayed our ally. We sold the South Vietnamese people down the river in that peace agreement signed by Nixon and Kissinger. I'm not saying they had any good option, but they chose the worst option. And I believe this is a stain on the American conscience. It certainly seems that way to me. And I think that is the reason we're not over this, because we have not faced that fact.
Some years ago, I was involved in a documentary project that we did here that we intended to be kind of an oral history, talking with Vietnam vets, looking back on their experience. And obviously, this was, I hesitate to extend from that to the experiences of just this about a dozen people that we talked to everybody. But, you know, we went out and we tried to find a fairly diverse group, and they were almost all men. We did have one woman who had been a nurse and one woman who had been in areas where there was fighting, but her job wasn't to fight. And we tried to ask some basic questions, and we had some people who, you know, who at the time thought that it was right, but have since decided that it was wrong. People who at the time that thought that it was right and still think that it's right. You know, some variety of ideas. And particularly, we were trying to ask questions about, to say to that person, well, if we can, take us back to the way that you felt at the time and tell us what you felt about the war then. And then now tell us what you think about the war now. And we're interested in how it is that their thinking about it might have changed. And I wonder, in your particular case, did you think at the time it was the right thing and now still do or have changed your mind? I'm just wondering personally what your feelings about the war were and are.
Well, my feelings were confused and still are confused. I can't give you a coherent answer because my thinking was incoherent. In about 64, when it became clear that Lyndon Johnson was flirting with the idea of going to war in Vietnam, of course, Kennedy had put advisory teams in there, but not combat maneuver units. The decision was Johnson's. I believed in 64, early 65, he made a huge strategic blunder. I believed we should not go into Vietnam. So that's one datum. When we went in, and in the summer of 65, when the Marines got into a horrific firefight in Quang Nai province near a place called Chu Lai, and they were saved, in quotes. They made extensive and effective use of naval gunfire. That's when my antennae went up, because I had been in a previous tour of duty in the Navy, a gunnery officer on a destroyer for 2 years. When I got off the destroyer, they sent me to the Marine Corps to be a naval gunfire liaison officer, naval gunfire spotter, one of these naval officers that goes with the Marines to provide naval gunfire support. So in the summer of 65, in August 65, there were two big marches in Washington against the war. I covered those for the Washington Star. I was a reporter for the old Washington Star. But when the Marine Corps started using naval gunfire, I thought, wait a minute, this is a very rare specialty, a naval officer who has served with the Marines and knows how to bring in gunfire to support the Marines. I wonder if I ought to be over there, even though I think it's a mistake. I didn't think it was a moral mistake. I thought it was a strategic mistake. The reason I say it was not a moral mistake is I believed, and I still believe, the people of South Vietnam wanted freedom. They had never been ruled from Hanoi. The country had never been ruled by a single unitary state with a regime in Hanoi. And those people in the South, and I later discovered it by talking to many of them, wanted to be independent. Not all of them, of course. It was a civil war. But in 65, I couldn't see myself sitting around Washington, D.C., even though I had a fascinating job as a reporter for the Washington Star, and not going over there when I had something to offer that seemed like the Marines needed. So I called the Bureau of Naval Personnel and said, here I am, my name is Don Farr, 617-647. I'm an experienced naval gunfire officer. Do you need people like me in Vietnam? Well, I had orders 3 days later and went to naval gunfire school again, 4 months. That was my second time through that school, and then 12 months in Vietnam. When I got there, I made another dumb mistake. I thought for sure, I don't mean my going in was a mistake, by the way. I thought for sure that the war would be short because we were expending such huge quantities of munitions. I got to Da Nang every night. You know, I'd hear 200-300 reports of 105-millimeter, 155-millimeter howitzer going off and harassing and interdiction fires. Well, you know, I thought the war was going to be over quick because we were hitting them so hard, but we weren't hitting them. We were hitting the trees. And then as my experience deepened in Vietnam, I felt this horrific tension in Vietnamese society. There were people who wanted to be free. It wasn't so much that they were anti-communist, although some were. The Catholics especially, who had migrated south in 1954. But a lot of people on the Vietnamese side, in the ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, just didn't want to be ruled by people in Hanoi, communist or non-communist. I think the war was a noble cause, as Ronald Reagan said. But it was so screwed up in the execution that it's very hard to look back on it and say, well, I would be for that war again today. I might be for it if we had done it differently. William Westmoreland didn't know what he was doing. Lyndon Johnson is, in my view, a blood-soaked buffoon. So's Robert Strange, McNamara, that whole clown group in Washington, D.C. that screwed this thing up. And so it's, you know, it's not anything you can look back on and say, hey, we did the right thing. Maybe we tried to do the right thing. We did it all wrong.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Don Farr. He is a novelist, has been a journalist. He served in Vietnam and was decorated. He received the Bronze Star and Purple Heart. He's authored several novels. Two of them are set in Vietnam, one, Neverlight, and his most recent, which was published last fall, The Fearless Man. It's published by Random House. And if you go looking for the book, by the way, his last name is spelled P-F-A-R-R-E-R. And it is in bookstores now. Questions, comments are certainly welcome as we continue to talk with him. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here, someone in Belgium over by Danville, line number four. Hello.
Good morning, sir. Mm-hmm. As in the very first war, and even to this war today, sometimes people don't get coordinates right, and they land on other people. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yes, I certainly do. You're right. Sometimes you give the wrong coordinates to the ship that's firing the weapons or to the artillery battery, and the wrong people get hit. And that's what they call collateral damage, and that's part of what I was talking about initially when I said that a naval gunfire spotter or a artillery forward observer, and I did both of those functions for the 7th Marines, knows what happens at the end of the trajectory. And as I said, it's not pretty. It's flying hot steel. Water buffaloes get killed. Wells get contaminated. Hooches get knocked over. And people get hurt and killed. So you have to balance that knowledge against the question, okay, are you just going to let the Marines advance on this objective without any cover at all? When a machine gun opens up on your guys, are you going to say, charge? No, that's not the way we do it. That's the way the Chinese Communist Army did it in Korea. It's the way, to some very large degree, the NVA did it in Vietnam. But it's not the way we do it in this country. And I cannot say that we were wrong to do what we did in Vietnam. I think we made excessive use of supporting arms. There's a really good book by Lewis Sorley called A Better War. Lewis Sorley points out, he's an Army veteran, that when Westmoreland was called back to Washington, it took him far too long to call back that incompetent fool. He was replaced by Abrams, and General Abrams radically reduced the use of heavy weapons. And the war started going much, much better because of that, but it was too late.
Sir, I think you missed my point. I was referring to when fellow Marines died. Thank you very much.
Well, that's what we call friendly fire. I don't know who it is that coined that term, but you want to talk about that?
Yeah. I'm not aware that any of the missions that I fired resulted in any friendly casualties. I do know that the Arvin had friendly casualties all the time. I know that friendly fire is a major problem. And one of the reasons we have the kind of structure that we have in the naval gunfire community is to avoid that. If you have a naval gunfire spotter with a line company, and he wants to fire a mission on certain coordinates, that mission has to be cleared by the naval gunfire liaison officer. I serve both functions, a spotter and liaison officer, depending on the situation, depending, frankly, on how big the operation was. If you see that the trajectory of your weapon is going to place friendly troops in jeopardy, then you disapprove that mission. He asks for permission to shoot it. You say, negative. Now, it might be that it would be dangerous with a naval gun, which has a long dispersion pattern, which is a flat trajectory, high-velocity weapon. But it would be pretty safe with a 105 howitzer, which has a parabolic trajectory. So that's the kind of decision the naval gunfire liaison officer or the artillery fire support coordinator has to make. But there's obviously one guy dying from friendly fire is one too many.
Well, let's talk with someone else. A caller here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, Well, I'm pretty disturbed by your tone, both your moral, quote, moral positions, and your perception of betrayal. The betrayal to me happened when we betrayed Ho Chi Minh at the end of the Second World War, when we told him that we would not support the French going back into Indochina and turned our backs on the independence movement. And it was not a moral war. It was a situation of us assuming the imperial mantle of the French when they got their butts kicked. And we've assumed the imperial mantle of the British in the whole Mid-Eastern mess. The people that got it right were the people that you disparagingly call draft dodgers, the people that resisted the war, the young people that were in the streets and brought the war to an end. You were wrong. Supporting American imperialism is wrong. It was wrong then. It's wrong now. You did nothing noble in Vietnam.
Well, Mr. Farr, you want to respond to what the caller said?
Sure. I didn't use the word draft dodgers in any general sense. The listener should know I referred to Bill Clinton as a draft dodger. A draft dodger to me is somebody not somebody who's conscientiously opposed to the war. You've never heard me attack them, and I never will because I never have. Clinton dodged the draft by writing a letter to the chief of the ROTC unit at the University of Arkansas, asking to get into ROTC in order to avoid combat service, in order to be exempted from the draft, the way Dan Quayle did in Indiana, only he went into the National Guard, the way George W. Bush did, going into the Air National Guard in Texas. It was Clinton that I called a draft dodger. I have profound sympathy for the people who were conscientiously opposed to the war, because I agreed with them on the major strategic question, that it was a mistake to do it. As far as whether or not the war is a moral enterprise, clearly every person makes his own judgment on that. I've made mine, you've made yours. But what is usually missing, and I don't know enough about your position to know whether it's missing from your thinking or not, is any appreciation of the fact that it was a civil war. That means that one side did not want to be ruled by the other. And until an opponent of the war takes that into his thinking, it seems to me that it's kind of arrogant to throw around terms like immoral. The reason I call it a noble cause is that there were people in the South who wanted to be free. And we were trying to help them. Of course it was part of the Cold War. It was part of the great struggle between communism and democracy. And I think that the moral distinction between communism and democracy is a pretty clear one. You may not, but I do.
Do you think that this was a war that we could have won?
Well, not after years and years of lies from Westmoreland and Johnson and McNamara, because the political capital necessary to support the war had been used up. By the time of the Tet Offensive in January of 68, people had been told for two or three years by that time, that there was light at the end of the tunnel. And so when it turns out that the VC had the capacity to launch an attack on every major city and many, many of the minor cities and military posts in the entire country of South Vietnam, then everybody said, let's get the hell out of this thing. And the country turned on a dime into opposition to the war. So if we had done it right in the first place, I think we probably could have saved South Vietnam the way we saved Korea. And you would have two countries there now, the way you have two countries in Korea. And maybe eventually there would be unification on a democratic basis, the way there was between East and West Germany. So, David, it's hard to say if we could have won. We couldn't have won the way we did it. Because, as I referred to a moment ago, the use of supporting arms was so heavy that we alienated a lot of the population.
In the book, there are a number of characters, but essentially there are two main characters, two central characters. At least it seems that way to me, particularly if you look at the two. There are also kind of two parallel stories going here. There's the story of what's going on the ground in Vietnam, and then there's a home front story. And one basically involves the men because they're there in Vietnam fighting, and the other involves the women because they're the ones that are back home. The central characters in the war story are two. There is a man who is a Marine company commander who has been there for a while and is experienced with combat. And then there is a man who was a chaplain who, for a number of reasons that aren't completely clear, maybe not even clear to that character, he decides to go to see what's going on, to experience that. And it certainly seems that your, I don't know if sympathies are the right word, but your feelings are with the man there in combat, and perhaps that's because you were there and experienced it yourself. What is it that you're, what kind of understanding would you like people to come away with if they read this book and try to get to know these characters, particularly the Marine commander, McHugh Clair?
Well, and this goes back to what your previous caller was criticizing me for, too. What I want the book to show is the struggle of McHugh Clair, who's the company commander, and of Paul Ladrano, who's the Catholic chaplain, to do what they think they must do and to do what they think is right in the circumstances that they are in. Neither one of these guys started the war. I didn't start the war. Whether the war was noble or not is, as I said a moment ago, a matter of opinion. It's a matter almost of philosophy. But once you're in it, if you're a company commander, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to accomplish your mission with a minimum of friendly casualties. You're supposed to be smart enough, tough enough, quick enough to get most of your guys through. If you're the chaplain, you are there to offer spiritual counsel, guidance, and comfort to the Marines who want it, the Marines who need it. You're not there to decide whether or not the war is in accordance with God's will or not. If you conclude that it is not, obviously you ought to get out of there, or else you ought to minister accordingly. But it's my hope that people who read The Fearless Man and also those who read Neverlight will see the complexity of the issues which your most recent caller totally ignores. It's far more complex than supporting American imperialism. It's far more complex also than just the nobility of the cause that I have talked about. All of these major rhetorical categories conceal the shadings, the fissures, the cracks, the complexities. If you take the thing as it happens, day to day on the ground, which is why I wrote this book, The Fearless Man, so people can enter into the experience minute by minute on the ground, I think if they do, they will be less inclined to think of the war in simplistic terms, either those of a jingoistic patriot or those of somebody who is anti-U.S.,
It seems that one way of looking at these two characters is that here we have two individuals who have, to some degree, chosen to test their professionalism under the most extreme conditions that you could possibly imagine. That is, for the soldier, the war, and perhaps also for the chaplain, war. And I guess that gets me thinking about whether it's possible, if you find yourself in a situation that might be at best morally ambiguous and at worst immoral, and one can make their own decision about what that is, how one does that, and can you come away as a third party observer? Is it really possible to admire someone for conducting themselves in a professional manner in a situation that you think shouldn't have happened in the first place? I mean, how do you sort those things out?
I think with difficulty, and maybe you never do get them sorted out. What happens in a combat situation is that, and this may be good, it may be bad, but what happens is that you become part of your unit, your team. There's them and us. There are those across the rice paddy who are trying to kill me and the guy next to me. I rely on the man on my left, the man on my right, and they rely on me. And this is true whether I'm a rifleman, a naval gunfire spotter, an artillery FO, an air forward air controller, a platoon leader. Whatever my job is, we rely on each other. At that point, when you see those yellow flashes in the greenery, you're not thinking about American imperialism. You're not thinking about communism or capitalism. Those abstractions are they're part of another world. You're thinking about survival, and you're thinking about who's going to win this fight. The two questions are connected. And as to the morality of it, it's killing. and for centuries, people have... Wait a second while I cough a minute. For centuries, people have looked to churches or other spiritual advisors to tell them it is okay to do this. And so the Catholic Church evolves the just war doctrine. If the war is just and you have to do what you have to do and you do it within the laws of your country, and we're part of we're signatories of the Geneva Conventions, then it's okay. But here's the way I look at it. I feel that the Marines in Vietnam and the Marines in Iraq today are sent there as, and the Army too, obviously, Air Force, Navy, everybody. They're sent there as champions of this country. As in medieval times, they used to avoid massive bloodshed by having one champion fight another champion. And whichever guy won, his side won. So what happens to the champion when he comes home with blood in his hands? He is, in the normal course of things, exonerated by his community, his nation. The nation affirms that what he did as a part and representative of the nation. The difference with Vietnam, and what sets Vietnam aside from all other wars this country has ever fought, even the War of 1812, is that when the Vietnam veterans came home, they did not receive that exoneration the champions ordinarily do. And that's why the Vietnam veterans are a distinct group, because they fought, many of them draftees, many of them having no control whatsoever over what they did. I mean, you know, they didn't want to be there, but they were there. And when they came back, instead of receiving the exoneration that fighters usually do, they were ignored.
I have a couple of callers here I want to get to, and I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with novelist and journalist Donald Farr. He served in Vietnam, was decorated, awarded the Bronze Star and Purple Heart. When he came back, he covered the anti-war movement for the Milwaukee Journal. He was a newspaper reporter, as he had been before he went to Vietnam. He later became the Journal's senior political reporter. He is the author of altogether four novels, Cold River, Never Light, Temple and Shipman, and his most recent, published last fall, The Fearless Man. It's published by Random House, and The Fearless Man is set in Vietnam, as is his second book, Neverlight. He now makes his home in Massachusetts and is joining us this morning by telephone. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have some more folks here to talk with. I think next is Champagne, and I believe that's line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm sure you're right about the experience of being in a position to kill and being killed in combat in Vietnam, but I'm not sure you're at all right about the history that got people in that position in the first place. When you say it was a civil war and we were on the side of people who wanted to be free, it seems to me you're buying a good bit of the American account of what it was doing in Vietnam, which, after all these years, really can't be sustained. As you know, the bulk of the war was carried out against South Vietnam, our supposed allies. That's where we dropped most of our ordnance. That's where we killed most people. And we were attacking South Vietnam from the Kennedy administration because there was a resistance movement, because the South Vietnamese didn't want the government that we had picked out for them. And we kept sending troops to make sure that they would. It was a demonstration war against the ongoing anti-Japanese, anti-French, and eventually anti-U.S. resistance, in which we would establish puppet government after puppet government. But to say it was a civil war and to say that we were fighting for those who wanted to be free is a vast overstatement of what the U.S. was doing there.
Well, Mr. Farr?
Well, of course, it's impossible to say how many people in that country didn't want to be ruled by the North. Because it was a civil war, that demonstrates that there were numbers on both sides sufficient to sustain the conflict. The conflict went on for from, I don't know when it started, probably you want to, when do you want to say it started? In the South. But the fact remains, and your caller, David, ignores this, that the VC cadres in the South were led by Northerners who were infiltrated down beginning shortly after World War II. By 1954, there was a huge resistance in the South. There's no doubt about it. That. And Lyndon Johnson went into Vietnam in a heavy way in 65, 66, because the country was in danger, that is, the South Vietnam, was in danger of being cut in half by a VC NVA army. There's no doubt about that. I would never say that there was X percent of people in the South who didn't want to be ruled by the North. But the fact that they resisted for 20 years or so seems to demonstrate that there were some. Obviously, it's part of the Cold War. And I refer again to something I said about 5 minutes ago. If you're on the side of the communists during the Cold War, then it's pretty easy to justify Ho Chi Minh and all of his people. And I'm not particularly interested as a novelist in the politics of the war, although much of this discussion has focused on that. I'm interested in the experience of American men in combat fighting in dubious battle, fighting a war that ultimately their country did not support, fighting a war that created a huge resistance movement, anti-war movement, that is to say, anti-U.S. war policy movement in this country. And they were keenly aware of that. I'm interested in the experience of men. I'm interested in the effect of combat on the personalities, the psyches, the mentalities of these men. That's why I'm a novelist and not a professor. That's why I'm a novelist and not a person writing a history of the war. There's plenty of that. I wanted to show what it was like for the men who were over there doing it, and that's why I wrote the book that I wrote. In Neverlight, my first novel about the Vietnam War, the male protagonist is a naval gunfire liaison officer over there fighting. The female protagonist is his wife, Catherine Vale. She gradually evolves a position, a philosophical position of opposition to the war, while her husband is in Vietnam. If your caller is interested in my view on that, he could read Neverlight and get perhaps a more nuanced impression of what I think about all this. Or perhaps, sir, you could read, if you can dig them up, two series of articles I wrote from Toronto for the Milwaukee Journal about draft evaders in Canada, and see whether or not there's a sympathetic presentation in those articles of what those guys were all about, as well as their girlfriends. I think that a lot of this static has been generated by my use of the term noble cause when I talk about the Vietnam War. I refer in that phrase to the cause of freedom, of liberty, the chance to go to the church you want to go to form associations, to start businesses, to live your life. And that is what those people, the ones who resisted the communist onslaught, that's what they were fighting for, and we were helping them to do that.
Do you hope that if people read this book and come away with some greater understanding of what combat is like for people who have never and will never, that will do something to, or that will shape their willingness as citizens to endorse the use of American military force around the world?
Yes, I do. because I think that the present war is full of parallels to the Vietnam War that are pretty chilling. I don't mean to say that I think that these parallels necessarily show or demonstrate or prove that we're going to lose in Iraq the way we lost in Vietnam. There are good reasons to think we won't lose in Iraq. For one thing, you've got Shia and Kurds, and they want to get their country back in the post-Saddam regime. There was nothing quite as strong as that in Vietnam. The South Vietnamese government was too corrupt. The Arvin, although they're nowhere near as bad as people paint them, the Arvin were not competent enough. But if you look at the Iraq War, what do you see? On the American side, a very small, very thin slice of American society is doing all the dying over there. Perfect parallel to Vietnam. Christian Appy wrote a book called The Working Class War about Vietnam, in which he documented what everybody knew. Dan Quayle dodged the draft. George W. Bush dodged the draft. Bill Clinton dodged the draft. All college boys. Who went over there as draftees? Blue-collar kids, black kids from the inner city, and lots of volunteers, too, of course. But it was a working-class war in that the college generation was totally exempted from it. That isn't fair. That is a hideous injustice. And now we don't have that same injustice in the same form because there's no draft. But I bet the sociology in the future, I can't say it, it's not documented the way Appy documented it for the Vietnam War yet, but I'll bet what you'll find out is that the guys fighting over there in Iraq and the women over there fighting for the American cause come from the same sociological, socioeconomic stratum as the ones who fought in Vietnam. This is no good. It means all of us back here are likely to develop some kind of free rider philosophy in which we expect our prosperity to be protected, our way of life, our materialism to be protected by this small group of people who are over there getting hurt. That's one parallel. And I think if you have an educated consciousness of the Vietnam War and what it was like for the men who lived it, then you'll be much more reluctant to jump into a place like Iraq or some other place and use war as your means of national policy. But I would never say that we have to totally abjure war and swear off it and say we're never going to fight anywhere. I don't think that makes any sense. But the a knowledge of the Vietnam War or the Korean War or World War II, any war, I think, makes it far more difficult for a policymaker to say, okay, we can whack them, therefore we will whack them, because you never know what's going to happen when you whack somebody. You never know how a war is going to turn out. You never know the imponderables, and we're seeing that demonstrated in Iraq today.
We have about 10 minutes, and we have a number of other callers. The lines are full. I want to try to get at least a couple more people before we find ourselves out of time. We'll go next to Indiana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two things. One, have you ever read The Naked and the Dead? And two, do you knowingly know that you're responsible for killing children and women with your having the Navy guns come in?
I think that I must have. Do I know it? You said, do I knowingly know it? Like, you mean, is it absolutely firm knowledge? No. But it seems to me very likely. And that's what I was trying to get at in something I said very early in the program. I don't know if you heard it or not. That this is something that a man cannot forget. That possibility is something a man cannot forget. John McCain has spoken on this. You drop a bomb, you don't know who's down there or who gets hit with it, but somebody does. What was the first part of your question?
He asked you if you'd read Naked and the Dead.
Oh, The Naked and the Dead, yes. It's funny, I'm looking across my workroom right now at a copy of The Naked and the Dead. I have the 50th anniversary edition of that book. I have not read it since I was about 25. I read it then. My plan is to read it again. That's why I bought this new edition. Why do you ask that, sir?
I don't know. The caller hung up, and I don't. You know, perhaps he. I know that this is a novel by Norman Mailer, and I know that there are a lot of people who think that it's one of the Among the best books about war.
Yes, that's right.
That there are. I must say I have not read the book myself, so I don't have an opinion one way or another. But I know there are a lot of people who admire that book for that very reason. And it's about World War II.
Yes, right, in the Pacific.
Yeah. Well, let's go to another caller here. That would be Champagne in line one. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think you missed the point, earlier caller, and you know, for whatever reasons, the Vietnamese and, for that matter, American soldiers on either side of the war were themselves fighting for, at the level of United States policy, it was really about protecting economic interest and certainly the ability of U.S. based corporations to, you know, operate how they want, anywhere they want. And I think the Iraq War is really about that, too. But that aside, going back to Vietnam, I just think that, you know, the idea that we were there to fight for some kind of democratic notion is a veneer, you know, that was put on the policy to make it palatable, because, you know, I mean, if you were really naked in explaining the real reasons for the war, it wouldn't have had the support that it had in the beginning, you know, and I think, you know, we just keep going over the same thing, and we're doing it now in Iraq. If you want any evidence for why, you know, we're not really interested in having an independent democracy in Iraq, even though it might get forced upon us, just look at the 100 points that Paul Bremer imposed upon Iraq before he left and turned over to the provisional government. You know, it's pretty clear that they really wanted to hem in what their options are.
Well, I think it's impossible to disentangle what you call American corporate interests with the interests of capitalism. And then if you see capitalism as engaged in a 50-year struggle against communism during the Cold War, one has to admit, and I would never deny, and, you know, I never have denied, that American corporate interests played some role in the formulation of Vietnam War policy, because Johnson was trying to win the Cold War. He was fighting a battle in the Cold War, which was a war not just of freedom against oppression, but of capitalism against communism. So I have no quarrel with that whatsoever. I mean, and clearly, if Iraq were Darfur or someplace like that without oil, our policy would be a hell of a lot different. So I don't have any dispute to offer to what the last caller has just said. I just don't know how you can live life without living in an economic universe. And you know, if you take the Korean War, North Korea attacked South Korea, and we fought for South Korea. That was part of the same struggle as the Vietnam War, part of the Cold War. I'm not philosopher enough or economist enough to know how you take economic interests out of national policy. And, you know, it's clear that in any war, if one side wins, then that one side, if there are economic stakes involved, like oil or like territory or water, one side is going to be advantaged by victory over the other. But in general, I have no quarrel with what the last caller has just said, David.
Way back at the beginning of the program, we were talking about the fact, a couple of things. First of all, that as much as we might like to think it, the country has not put Vietnam behind it, and that there are a lot of people who still personally feel touched by it. Certainly, you wrote a little article for the Boston Review where you talked about the fact that you feel that it was the most transforming experience of your life. And I certainly have heard that from a lot of other vets, and I don't doubt that for a moment. There are obviously, we also know many ways, maybe too many to articulate, or they're difficult to describe, that war. In many ways, it has affected this country. I guess I'm wondering whether you can speculate now we're involved in another war, that it does involve a lot of people directly, and then it involves their families indirectly, that I'm sure for them that also will be, may well be, the most transforming experience of their life. And we're expecting this is going to go on now, maybe for a number of years. What does that do? What do you think that might do to this country?
Well, I think Vietnam not only transformed my life, it transformed this country. It was a part of a concatenation of forces. Women's liberation, the civil rights movement, and the Vietnam War all happened more or less simultaneously. And the country is not the same. The Iraq War, I think, is hard to predict. If we leave Iraq soon enough, and Iraq does stand up as a viable nation, and if there's some semblance of democracy, in other words, if the administration's program is achieved even 50%, even 25%, I don't think it'll have the horrendous effect on the country's psyche as Vietnam is having has had, because of the lie that I think we're living about Vietnam that we won't face, the fact that we sold the South Vietnamese down the river. So I think that's a major difference. But if your brother is killed in Iraq, or your sister loses a foot to a mine, your family is going to be marked for life. And that's true in any war. It's certainly true in Iraq.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. I'm sorry to say we've simply used our time. If you want to read the book we've talked about, it's titled The Fearless Man. It's published by Random House by our guest, Don Farr. Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Delighted to be your guest, David.
The show, Focus 580, made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from the Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff there at the Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at one of the most successful players in the airline industry today. Our guest will be journalist Barbara Peterson. Her latest book looks at the success of JetBlue. She joins us this afternoon at 1:06 Central Time. It's 1 minute before noon Central Time. Let's take a look at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat trading at 295 and a quarter, down 1/4. July, 310 and 3/4, down 1/4. March corn, 199 and 3/4, up 1/2. May, 207 and a half, up 1/2. July,